Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. As I mentioned last week, got a great new interview up with the wonderful children's book author and illustrator Nina Layden. What a great story about a first book that she has, how she got that first book published. So if you haven't checked it out yet, go over to authormagazine.org and check it out. Also, we're funded, of course, by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, who have been supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn about the PNWA at pnwa.org. But you might want to go there and check it out, because their conference is coming up in July. I know there's still spots available, but boy, it's one of the oldest and best writers' conferences in the country. So if you're anywhere in the Northwest, you can go there. We have dozens of agents and editors from New York and all over the country. Workshops galore. I'll be teaching a memoir masterclass on Thursday, the first day of the conference. Donald Moss will be there doing his breakout workshop. Just going to be a great conference. So check it out at pnwa.org, pnwa.org. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to today's guest. We're going to talk about something that is near and dear to me, mindfulness, and how it relates to writing. It's very relevant to writing. It's perhaps, I got to say, when I began sort of being aware of mindfulness and all that it means, my writing life improved dramatically. And today's guest, Nigel Wellings, knows all about it. He's a psychoanalytic psychotherapist who has been teaching and writing about the relationship between psychotherapy and Buddhism for the last 16 years. And he served as a director of training at the Center for Transpersonal Psychology, is a founding member of the Forum for Contemplative Studies, and a facilitator on the Bath and Bristol mindfulness courses. And with Elizabeth McCormick, he's written and edited several books, including Nothing to Lose, Psychotherapy, Buddhism, and Living Life. And we're going to be talking about his most recent book, Why Can't I Meditate? How to Get Your Mindfulness Practice on Track. Nigel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, Nigel, so you've dedicated your life, either deliberately or maybe by just the accident of pursuing your passion, to the combination of psychotherapy and Buddhism. I've talked to a few psychologists or therapists who have begun to blend the sort of scientific practice of psychotherapy with spirituality. How did you come to blend these two things?
I like the notion that you just kind of fall into things, the one you just suggested.
Yeah.
And I think when I was in my early 20s, I was involved in a spiritual community. And that spiritual community seemed to be very devoted to bed swapping, which caused the most enormous amount of unhappiness and quite a lot of children who weren't quite sure who their parents were.
Right.
So I really became interested in the psychology of that community, and hence my career was born.
Oh, you see, how lucky were you? Interesting. So you started out sort of in a spiritual community, and then you got interested in the psychology of it, and so here you are today. All right. And interestingly, so Why Can't I Meditate is a book for people who either would like to start what we're going to talk about, what a mindfulness practice is, or have started one and are having trouble with it. Let's sort of define our terms. How do you describe, when you say to people, I have a mindfulness-based psychotherapeutic practice, and people go, huh? What do you say to them?
Good question. I try to avoid that question, like the plague.
Yeah, I'll bet.
But if cornered, I say it's actually basically about moving away from our story of who we are, our narrative, and going down a level into our bodies, which are profoundly emotional. Our emotions and our bodies are more or less the same thing. And learning to be present with our emotions in our body. Now, that sounds like a simple thing to say, but of course it's not.
No.
Many of us suffer from emotions that we really don't want to feel. And we spend a great deal of energy making sure we don't feel them. So turning towards feeling perhaps sad or feeling angry, where do I feel that in my body? Being able to make that my object of mindfulness, that means the place where I rest my attention and keep it there, is a difficult thing to do. It's making friends with parts of ourselves that we really don't necessarily want to go that close to.
So yeah, so
I think in that sense, that's the essence of it.
Yeah. Instead of running away from certain feelings, trying to go into them in a hope to understand. I guess, you know, one of the things I write about this subject in a way a lot, not as specifically as you do, but one of the things I talk to my students about and what I write about is, are you going to look upon pain as punishment or information? You know, is it guidance? Is it telling you where your attention's going, or is it simply something punishing you, as would, a capricious parent, for instance?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, there's a link there with something we talk a great deal about, which is lifted from Buddhism, which is the first and second arrow, which is life produces lots and lots and lots of pain, lots of unsatisfactory experiences, traumatic experiences. Mostly there's very little we can do about that. But our relationship to those experiences, which is the second arrow, we have complete control over. So we don't control the first, but we do control the second. So if I find myself really fighting against my experience, at war with myself for having the emotions that I have, then I'm actually doubling the suffering. And we can do something about that. That fits with what you're saying, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, there's that great story, I think it's from Buddhism, where there's two Buddhists who are walking together, and they're crossing a stream or something, and one helps a woman across the stream, which they're not supposed to do. They have some sort of, you know, there's a vow they had, you know, taken not to touch women, or I forget what it is. And
that's it.
And is that the one? And then later on, the one is still upset about the fact that he touched the woman, held the woman, and the other says, "I've put her down already. Why are you still carrying her?" Is that the second arrow?
Exactly.
Theory?
Yeah. That's the second arrow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the second arrow.
Oh boy.
He's making himself bad or wrong for having the experiences that he's having, and that's the one we have some control over.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
And that's the practice of mindfulness is sort of being. To me, I think of it as: am I aware of the stories I'm telling? You know, because when I write, I'm aware of the story I'm writing. This is the story I want to tell myself. I want to share with others. I'm going to be deliberate about the story I'm telling. For me, I've noticed all my suffering is from the stories I don't know I'm telling myself. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Why didn't you do this? Oh, and that to me has been the source of my suffering throughout my life. It's just not even knowing that I'm telling myself those stories.
Yeah, that's right. And the weird thing is, isn't it, even when we do become conscious of them, we still continue to tell them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Ourselves them.
Absolutely.
We still suffer.
Yes.
Yeah, there's something compulsive about a story.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so why can't I meditate? So let's talk about where this book came from. I assume in your practice you started meeting a lot of people who could not either bring themselves to meditate or having a horrible time starting out, and you thought, this interests me. This difficulty in just beginning.
Yeah.
Is that how it started?
Yeah. I mean, I've been around people trying to meditate for my entire life, really. I'm 62 now, so that's quite a long time. And, you know, everyone who's interested in meditation says I don't meditate enough, and I feel bad about it. And that certainly includes me.
Really?
Absolutely. Yes, we always write books about what we're bad at. You know that.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
So I'm rubbish at meditating. And I'd not really paid much attention to that until, I suppose, 10 years ago, we started the Bath and Bristol mindfulness courses, which were teaching mindfulness not in a Buddhist context, but in a secular context.
Right.
Very much growing out of Jon Kabat-Zinn's work, whom I know you all know in the States very well.
Yeah.
Mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR.
Yeah.
And so we were teaching the 8-week courses, and people were loving the courses, and saying they really took away something valuable from them. But we also realized that perhaps the majority of people weren't actually continuing to practice mindfulness meditation once the course started. And given that's what the course was all about, teaching you how to do it, that seemed to me really important.
Right.
So I started talking to other people who taught it, and the heads of Oxford and Bangor universities here, where they teach mindfulness teaching, and everyone said the same. Yeah, the courses go down really well, but the continuing of practice is really low. So I became interested, and the book grew from there.
I love what you said.
Can I say about how that happened?
I am, but I want to stress something to my listeners. I do this from time to time. Did you hear what he said? He said, "I got interested. I got interested, and the book grew from there." You know what I'm interested in, Nigel? I'm interested in people getting interested. I find people getting interested interesting. That just something lights up in the distance, and from that, this book is born. And so, okay, so you got interested in that little struggle there. That challenge, and you must have recognized it in yourself too at that point, the same sort of challenge. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what?
So I started talking to people.
Yeah.
So I spoke to two groups of people. One group I call struggling meditators, so that's me as well, and also professional mindfulness meditation teachers, and I spoke to a whole spectrum of them, different sorts of Buddhist ones. And also different sorts of secular ones. And what came out of that was actually 100% consensus from the mindfulness teachers about the thing that stops us practicing. And from the struggling meditators, what I discovered was that there were layers of resistance in all of us, which if they began to practice quite seriously, that means doing it a bit each day and creating something of a discipline, that they began to get in touch with themselves in a certain way that they found uncomfortable. And it was exactly that discomfort that the meditation teachers were talking about. So right. So in that sense, the experience of the struggling meditators and the teachers came together perfectly. And out of those interviews and me trying to make sense of it, the book was born.
Interesting. And so it was the avoidance of meditation was an avoidance of discomfort, was simply an avoidance of discomfort, an attempt to avoid discomfort. It was on such a low level that they didn't even recognize the discomfort, probably.
Yeah, and that's how the book builds. So it starts off a very, very simple level about just forming what I call a mindfulness habit, which is establishing a way of practicing every day so you don't really think about it. So a metaphor here is cleaning your teeth. We don't think about cleaning
right.
our teeth. We just get up and do it. Do I feel like cleaning my teeth? I never think like that. I just do it.
Right.
So that's how we need to start off. And then as the book progresses and goes deeper and deeper and deeper, my psychoanalytic knowledge begins to come in. And I talk about making contact with places of deep hurt inside us, often going back to the depths of our childhood. And as we begin to touch into those places, which actually mindfulness meditation is designed to do, it's not about having a nice time. It's about making a deep insight into ourselves. As we begin to gain that insight, then we also come across parts of ourselves that really don't want to do it. And then there's a tension there. So many of us, when we sit, the first thing we experience is our monkey mind. It's really difficult to just stay. Then our legs begin to hurt. Then it's boring. And then we think, why the hell am I doing this stupid thing? Why did I pay all this money for the course?
Right.
And if we get past that, we then start getting in touch with thoughts, emotions, behaviors that we really don't want to go near. So it just goes down and down and down.
Yeah. You know what it reminds me of? I coach writers, and a common experience for them, and it sounds very similar to what you try to help folks with the meditation, is they want to write, they love to write, but they avoid it. And they always avoid it because there's something waiting for them at the desk that they don't want. There's some experience in addition to the pleasant part of writing, because there always is a pleasant part of writing, that they find unpleasant, but they don't know what it is. They don't understand it, but they know it's waiting for them. And so it keeps them away from the desk. It keeps them away from doing something they actually want to do. And then they feel bad about not doing it, just to add to that, you know, the punishment a little bit more.
Yeah.
It sounds like the same,
it's
similar.
Parallel.
Yeah.
Completely parallel to that. It's completely parallel to that. In fact, when I was reading around the subject, I actually read a book on writer's block, which gave me some of the ideas for the book.
Huh. Oh, interesting. And so tell me, so Nigel, describe for me, for you, you say you're rubbish, but you can't have every single meditation practice be rubbish. You would never do it. So there must be some experiences where you come out feeling glad you did it. What is a good session of meditation feel like? What do you call it? Do you call it a session? Do you call it a period of meditation? A sitting. Okay.
Sitting.
What's a good sitting feel like for you? What is it like?
Well, I think the question has immediately led us into trouble, because the first thing to do is to get rid of the notion of a good sitting. So that was a great question you asked there, Bill.
Okay, good.
Because it's the question which everybody says, tell me what a good one feels like. And actually, that is complete poison for the practice. Because what the practice is trying to do is just trying to help us to sit and be present with exactly whatever experience we're having, whether we would normally term it a good experience or a bad experience or an indifferent experience. So really what the practice is doing is not generating good alternative states of mind where I feel happy or chilled or blissful, but it's more fundamentally trying to cultivate a state of equanimity towards whatever experience I have arising. So an acceptance, a non-judgmental acceptance of whatever I'm experiencing. So I can be, you know, sad or mad or bad, and just really noticing how it just simply comes and goes. So the change which comes out of the practice isn't having a good experience, it's having an ability to accept and be present with exactly what we're experiencing, whatever it is. That's what's good.
Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Hi, Bill.
Ah, once again, I was cut off from the internet by the Blog Talk Radio, so I've had to call in on my phone. Nigel, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, fabulous.
Did we get cut off there?
Well, I know. You stayed on, but for some reason it cut off my microphone, so I'm having to talk via the phone. But I'm glad you stayed on like a trooper, and you were in the middle of a great thought about why it is poison to say, what's a good meditation? And I'm sorry that I missed some of your answer. Would you be willing to share the rest of it with me?
I've said
why
it a thousand
poison.
Times, so I'm happy to say it again.
Good. Thank you.
If we start picking between good and bad experiences, what we would normally call good or bad experience. So good experience, people would say, oh, I'm feeling really kind of chilled and happy and calm. I like that. And a bad experience would be my mind's going mad. I can't stop thinking about my job and my kids. I can't bear this. My bottom hurts. I'm getting up. That would be called a bad one. And what we're trying to do is actually stop that picking and choosing, and instead just be really, really present with both of those sorts of experience, so that what arises is the ability to have some equanimity, I love that word, towards both of them. So, you know, it's like, so the question, did I have a good meditation? A good meditation means I can be present with exactly whatever experience I had, and I'm not picking and choosing between them.
Right, right.
You know, if we don't do that, then it turns into just the same old consumerism, doesn't it, that kind of pervades our entire society, you know, where we're constantly trying to get something that we like and want and pushing away stuff that we don't like and that we don't want. And as we know, that goes nowhere. It just goes on forever.
That's right. That's an excellent point, because you're really trying to say there is no such thing as a bad meditation. That in the same way, that in a way, there isn't such a thing as a bad writing session, even though there are sessions where I might only get a page or a half a page. I feel like I learned something even in those sessions, for all the things I try that don't work, for all the things that I maybe struggle with and all the questions about myself that come up. I can either use those experiences or call it failure, and then I don't gain much from it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's like, again, you've got a really good parallel there. I think that's a fantastic parallel. Because the secret of writing is you just need to sit down and have a go. It doesn't mean that you don't edit it out later, but if you don't do it, then you've got nothing to start from the next time. You've just got to do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can't, because in fact, it's funny I'm talking to you, Nigel, because I'm writing a book about writing, and I'm writing about mindfulness in the chapter I'm working on right now, oddly enough. And I was comparing it to my meditation practice, and I'm never more deliberate with my thought than when I'm writing. You know, I don't think any old thing. I do get in a flow where things come, but I'm deliberate about the nature of what's coming through me, as opposed to when I wander around the day, all kinds of crap comes up that I might pursue that doesn't do me any good. But when I'm writing, I'm as on purpose as I can really be. I don't know if you have that experience, but certainly what I've developed in my writing.
I certainly know the experience of all the crap coming up throughout the day.
No, wait, but has your meditation helped you when that starts? Because sometimes I've gotten to the point now, Nigel, sometimes, where I'm following some train of thought that's leading me right to some cliff that I don't want to go to, but I'm chasing it anyway because that's what I do, where I'm able to actually stop the train or slow the train and get off of it. And it's been partly meditation and writing that's helped me do that. Now, surely you've had that experience in your daily life too, after all these years of meditating.
Yeah, one of the big influences in our course is not big influence. The big idea is making a change from unconscious, often very destructive emotional reactivity,
right,
to something a bit wiser, a bit kinder, which could be a response.
Right.
And for that, it requires that we're mindfully aware of what's going on in our mind, not just on the cushion or on the chair, but throughout the course of our day.
That's right.
And of course, that's why we practice. We practice for our day, don't we?
That's right.
It's for our life.
And
if we notice that, you know, that there are these really sort of destructive habitual patterns occurring, it gives us a chance to recognize it and then do something different, something
right.
which is better. And then, of course, because doing it once isn't going to make much difference, we have to do it again and again and again and again.
That's
and that way, we use our minds to rebuild our brains.
That's right.
And so, of course, it has an effect. And, you know, and as a psychotherapist, that's what I see all the time in myself and others. People bring in habitual patterns of hurt, often again with their roots in childhood, destroying their present relationships. And they just simply can't see that they're doing it. And so making that conscious is part of the psychotherapy, you know, bringing that story into awareness.
Yeah.
But what puts a point on the arrow, as it were, is to say, okay, I can see that I'm doing this in this moment, right now, I'm about to do it again, and catching myself, I can maybe just pull back from that reaction and find a wiser and kinder response.
Right.
I'm doing that over and over and over again. And yes, I have experienced that. I've deeply experienced that.
Yeah, yeah. As have I, and they've been some of the most instructive moments. And they're interesting moments because usually I was caught up in some story about what was happening, and I was feeling it. You know, I was feeling the momentum, the emotional momentum of whatever I believed, that someone I loved didn't love me, or this thing wasn't going to happen that I wanted to have happen, or I thought it had to happen, or else I would be miserable, or whatever it was. And that moment where I said, I know I'm feeling this, and I know it feels real, but what if it's not? What if it's not real? What if it isn't? And then seeing the momentum slow and then being able to make another choice. It was profound. Just questioning the reality that seemed as real as a thunderstorm at that moment, you know. And all it was me thinking something. Oh, that's all it was. That's all it was.
So powerful and yet so simple, huh?
It is. It is.
We do logs in the second and I think third week of the courses. First is a log for pleasant events, and the second is unpleasant events. And one of the things that's amazing for many people, and it was for me when I did it, was that I would think, oh, I'm having this really crap week. There's all this horrible stuff going. I'm miserable all the time.
Right.
But on close observation, actually, that wasn't true at all. There was loads and loads of it where there was nothing much going on at all. And then there were bits of it where there was bits of pleasure and, you know, and enjoyment and laughter and seeing all sorts of stuff. And they were just being edited out. And, of course, the other way around as well, the happiness bit, lots of that's also edited out.
Yeah.
So, we're creating our world all the time.
And we are.
It feels real, but it's not necessarily true.
It is so true to the point where I was thinking about this subject as I was walking down the street the other day, and I thought, you know, the story is so powerful that all the people I'm passing, we're really not even walking down the same street. We're each of us really walking down our own street, the street that we believe in, the street that we're telling the story about. We think it's one street, which I understand it is physically, but really emotionally every street, everyone is walking side by side on a different street in the world.
Yeah, that's absolutely literally true.
Yeah, it's bizarre to think of.
It's literally true. The information that's coming in through our senses, which we construct the notion I'm walking down the street with, is actually very small, and the majority of the information we're providing unconsciously from within our memories, filling in all the gaps. And so, you know, it's something like 30, 70, I can't remember exactly, but I know the vast majority of it's coming from inside. And so we are literally creating our experience of walking down that street.
And you know what that's exactly like, Nigel, is, and I tell this to my writing students all the time, they worry about what the readers are going to read, what the readers are going to read, and it's so true, what the reader reads and what you write are largely different things. They have each, what they fill in, even in a book like yours, even if it's not fiction or if it's not poetry, if it's a nonfiction, the reader fills in so much, you can't, as a writer, even know what it is they're really reading. Because they fill in enormous, it's probably 30, 70. They do most of the work, the reader does, and they don't even realize it. It's their book.
And you can't control it.
No, you you can't. You can't. Oh, how I've wanted to. And I'll tell you what, I didn't get published for a long time for that very reason. I did not like the idea that I couldn't control it. And when I gave it up was when I started getting published.
Oh,
when I gave up needing control. Yeah, I think that was the problem. I wanted to have complete control over what they experienced, and it wasn't going to happen, was it, Nigel? Oh, it doesn't going to happen. Okay. Well, listen, you have to get to bed. I don't know if our listeners know it. They might have detected a slight accent. Nigel is actually calling from the British Isles, and it's much later there than it is here. So before I set
Bath.
You're in Bath, is that right?
Bath.
Before you go, though, you have to answer one more question for me. You finish this sentence. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
Ah, what an interesting question. This one sentence. I'm dyslexic. And,
really?
And the way my brain works is that I leap from one idea to another without actually filling in the gaps. And writing has taught me to slow down and fill in the gaps.
I love it. I love it.
Thank God for a spell check.
Writing has taught you to fill in the gaps. Amen. That is awesome. Well, Nigel, thank you so much for sticking it out through our technical glitches. The book is Why Can't I Meditate? How to Get Your Mindfulness Practice on Track. It's good for meditators. It's good for writers. It's good for everybody. Nigel, thank you so much.
thank you very much also. Good night.
All right. Take it easy.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Good night. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was great, wasn't it? Listen, next week, and hopefully there'll be no technical glitches next week, but I will be on with Nigel's publisher, Joel Fotinos, who's got a book about coming out about Road to Success on the Napoleon Hill's Thinking and Grow Rich phenomenon that has endured low these 100 years. And so I'll be talking to him. Until then, go fill in the gaps and do what you love to do.